This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is comic, actress, and writer Kara Leifer. She started working the comedy clubs when Paul Reiser, Jerry Seinfeld, and Larry David were getting started, and they became her friends. She later wrote for the NBC series Seinfeld. She's also had her own TV comedy specials. She's written a new memoir called When You Lie About Your Age, The Terrorists Win. She's 52 now. Her book is about a lot of the surprising changes she made in her life as she got older, like, after she turned 40, she decided she wanted to have a lesbian fling. That first fling turned into a committed relationship. Leifer and her partner adopted a son a few years ago, another big surprise, since until then, Leifer didn't think she wanted to have a child. Her memoir is also about comedy and how her father helped inspire her to become a comic. Kara Leifer, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Your opening essay in the new book is about your father, who recently died at the age of 86. And you write that he's the reason you wanted to be funny, because he was funny. And in this piece, you tell one of the jokes that he used to tell. It's a, quote, dirty joke that you didn't get when you were a kid. It is such a great joke, so I have to start by asking you to tell it.
Okay. Well, a guy goes to the movies with his pet chicken. And he buys two tickets, and the person says, who's going in with you? And he goes, well, my pet chicken here. And the ticket person says, hey, you can't bring an animal in the movie theater. So the guy goes around the corner. He stuffs the chicken down his pants, goes into the movies, and the movie starts. But the chicken is starting to get a little hot. So the guy unzips his fly to let the chicken stick his head out and get a little air. So a little bit of time has passed by, and a woman nudges her friend and says, you know, this guy next to me just unzipped his pants. And the woman goes, ah, look, you know, you've seen one, you've seen them all. And the woman goes, yeah, I know, but this one's eating my popcorn.
I love that.
Yes, hilarity ensues. But I remember as a kid, you know, my father telling this joke a lot and getting big laughs. And I was young enough that I didn't really understand it, you know, because all I heard was a chicken and, a zipper. And it didn't really make sense. I found out, you know, what the joke meant later. And that just might have been the thing that pushed me into lesbianism,
which we'll get to later.
I really, you know, my father was the king of the joke tellers, and I was so impressed as a child watching him hold people in rapt attention with these stories, and it had a big impact on me.
So did he actually collect jokes?
He did. My father, he was the kind of guy that, you know, he'd always say, throw at any subject and I got a joke on it. And he really, one of the high points of his life was my mom is a PhD in psychology, and she went to one of her psychology conventions, and the scheduled entertainment for that night had canceled. And the psychologist, knowing that my father was a big joke teller, asked if he would mind stepping in and telling some jokes. And as I hear it, you know, he was thrilled and delighted. And he, I think, told about a half an hour or 45 minutes of jokes, and he killed. And it was really a fantastic night for him.
Now, the essay that was the biggest surprise to me in your book is the one in which you explain that although you'd been married, although you'd always liked boys, you wanted to have a lesbian fling. And the woman you had that fling with more than 12 years ago has become your partner. You've since adopted a son. You have 7 rescue dogs together. So let's start at the beginning of this story.
Okay.
Why, after what being sounds like an enthusiastic heterosexual, did you decide that you wanted to try being with a woman?
I don't know what came over me, Terry. It just became this obsession. Remember, I really wanted to have an affair with a woman. I remember this movie Bound was out at the time.
Oh, Gina Gershon? Is that the Gina?
Yes, yeah. Yes. But I remember there were these sex scenes in Bound, and I must have burned through the videotape. I just watched it so much. It just became something I had to do. And you know, little did I know that this woman that I would meet at a charity event, at a Project Angel Food event, would, you know, be the woman who I had this fling with, who I didn't expect. I fell madly in love with, and here we are 12 years later.
When you realized that you were actually serious about her and her about you, and this was going to be a long-lasting relationship, did you have to, like, reorient parts of your identity? Because now you were in a lesbian relationship, in a long-term one. You know, so it wasn't about, like, having your lesbian fling. It was the real thing.
No. Mm-mm. No. It was difficult because I did approach this as, oh, you know, my fun, chic lesbian affair. This will be a great story. And I didn't expect to be captivated and to find myself really so in love in such a different way. And it was a difficult transition because, you know, it was like, this is supposed to be my fun fling. This was not supposed to be something to redefine me. It's a vast transformation. I mean, I have a joke about it in my book that, you know, I went to gay bookstores for help. You know, yes, excuse me, do you have what the f*** just happened to me? because it is that powerful transformation in your life.
So, and what does it say? Mm-hmm. What does it say? Do you think that you changed? That do you think you had, like, repressed feelings about girls when you were younger? Do you think that you were heterosexual at one time and that just changed? Do you think that it means you're bisexual, or that there's this kind of, like, shifting scale of sexuality and your scale shifted? I mean, do you think of sexuality, the nature of sexual orientation, differently than you did before?
I do. I think that what I've learned from the experience is that our sexuality is constantly evolving and can be a fluid thing.
Or at least for some people it can. I think for some people it probably can't be. On both ends.
I mean, yes. But I do think that it really did hit me like a bolt of lightning. And, and I'm not an unexamined person. I mean, I've been in therapy most of my adult life, you know. But I'm not sure. I mean, I do talk in the book about, you know, my first crush was on Davy Jones of the Monkees, you know. And I had a lot of powerful feelings for boys. But I remember as a kid being obsessed with Herb Alpert had this album cover. And it was a woman who was naked, who was covered with whipped cream. And I was really fascinated with it. And it's like, I don't know, was that some early indication of some attraction to women? I'm not sure, you know.
So how do you tell your parents when you're in your late 30s, you've been married, that you're actually now a lesbian?
Well, it was an interesting ride. You know, it had started a little bit earlier because really, I think 3 weeks after I met Lori, I had a breast cancer scare. And I went and had a mammogram. And it was the worst thing that, you know, a woman expects when you go to have a mammogram, where, you know, usually you're kind of in and out. And it was one of these, oh, stick around. The doctor wants to take more films, and then comes back again and take more films. And, you know, I basically left this radiologist's office that day with, you know, I cornered him as I was leaving, like, well, what do you think it is? And he was like, I think it's 80-20 probably cancer. And I was like, what are you basing that on? He was like, from 20 years of doing what I do. And, you know, I immediately called Lori. We'd only been together for 3 weeks, you know, even to the point where I wouldn't even have referred to her as my girlfriend yet. But something in my adrenaline made me reach out to her. And she was so rock solid to me in that moment. And I think about it a lot because it had such an impact on me and our relationship. It was like, you know, breathe and let's get through this and don't worry about it. And, you know, I really had a day, 24 hours, where I thought I had cancer. And she was amazing. I mean, she came over my apartment and brought a big basket of movies and thought we'd relax and hang out and kind of chill. But I was like, I need to get drunk. I just want to get drunk and you know, she took me to this great place that we like. She let me get drunk. She drove me home. And it turned out, you know, the next day I spoke to the doctor and it was a fibroadenoma, which is a non-cancerous tumor. But I had to go. I went back to New York to have this fibroadenoma out. And Lori came with me and we went and visited my parents on Long Island just to say hello before my procedure. So, you know, I was not ready to come out to my parents yet. This was still very new. So Lori came as my, quote, friend. Anyway, we saw my parents, and I had the procedure. About 6 months later, I called my folks up because I wanted to come to New York and tell them about meeting Lori and being gay now. And, you know, to Jewish parents, I mean, I called. I said, I want to come back to Long Island and talk to you about something. You know, the first thing my mother said was like, you're not sick, are you? It's like, no, I'm not sick. You promise you're not sick? No, I'm not sick. And I went back to talk to my parents about it. And I completely expected them to be very emotional about it and basket cases. And the kind of the flip thing happened. I was the basket case. I was so emotional. My parents were cool as cucumbers about it. And I was crying, actually. And, you know, my father, my dear, sweet father, was like, why are you crying? And I said, well, you know, I thought you would be disappointed. And my father said, disappointed? I'll tell you when I was disappointed, when you married that Shagetz, you know, which is Yiddish for a non-Jewish person. So they were amazing about it. But what I think was also very revealing was when I came home to come out to my parents, my mother did say to me, I knew when Lori came with you to come back for that procedure for the fibroadenoma that you were lovers. And she knew, she said, because we took a walk around the neighborhood that day and we walked ahead of my parents. And my mother said, I could tell the way you two were walking together that you were a couple. And I think that's so interesting. I mean, look, she is also a shrink. She might be a little more highly attuned to people and their behavior. But it's just interesting what you think you can hide that you can hide.
So you must have been really grateful to your parents for getting it.
And not
being upset or worrying, like, how are we going to tell our friends? Or, you know, like, don't bring her home.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I do think, though, that to me, like, the power of Judaism, it's like, you know, the fact that my parents met Lori, liked her, but, you know, the fact that she was Jewish is like, you know, she could have been a chimp. It's like, hey, she's Jewish. You know, it's like, add 1,000 points. They were just so thrilled and delighted, you know. The trade-off of a guy who's not Jewish to a woman who's Jewish, they were like, you know, hey, let's break out the Manischewitz, you know.
You never wanted to have children, and you had been married. I mean, you could have had children then. But when you were 50 and your partner Lori was 43, you both decided to adopt. What changed your mind about having children?
It's just still so interesting to me. I really, really thought not only, you know, I couldn't have children at that point, but I just never really wanted to have kids. And then it became more of a passion for Lori, and we started to talk about it. And then it just suddenly became something that we really wanted to do. And I that's what I love about, you know, adoption. It there's no age limit to it. And so at 50 and 43, we adopted our son Bruno, and it's really been amazing. It's been something that I never would have expected to be as great as it is. And what I love about it is that I think I'm so much of a better mother now at 52 than, oh God, I would have been at 42 or 32.
Why?
I just have a different pace to my life now than I did then. It was much more go, you know, turning on all cylinders. it's much easier for me to kick back now. And I think what really makes a great parent, especially now that I am a parent, is the ability to kick back and be with it and enjoy it, because I think it's all that's what a kid is all about. And what I think is so fascinating is all the platitudes that I'd heard about kids somehow start becoming real, you know. I'd always heard you kind of re-experience the world through your child's eyes. And it seemed kind of, dumb and fake to me. And it really happens.
Let's get back to telling jokes.
Okay.
You at the beginning of our interview, you were talking about your father and how he was a great joke teller and how you got started when you were still in college working as a comic. Do you now feel like there's a part of you that's attached to an older period of showbiz, one that doesn't exist anymore? I'm thinking, for instance, that I know in your collection of prized possessions, you have some cue cards that a patter between Milton Berle and Bob Hope from a special that you worked on. You opened for Sinatra in Vegas. You were on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Now, granted, this was late in Sinatra's life. It was late in Carson's career. But still, you were there for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also one of the things I love about, where I'm at in my life and my career. I've been doing what I do for, it's going to be 32 years. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me, that I've been doing what I love for so long. And the advantage of being, having been around for so long is that I have, been with the greats like Sinatra and, being on a Bob Hope special with Milton Berle. And, I'm very happy that I'm a little bit of a yenta that way, waiting around after a special like that. Like, would you mind very much if I took the cue cards, that kind of stuff, and making sure that I got a picture with Carson when I was on with him. But what I love about show business is that it is this long chain, and all these greats that went before me, and the evolution of comedy to, have been a part of it, even starting 30 years ago, and see how much has changed. And then, to be a part of it, even now, I just did a part in Judd Apatow's new movie that's coming out called Funny People with Adam Sandler. And in the movie, he has dinner with, some of the people, the comedy people he admired when he was coming up. And Paul Reiser was in the scene, and myself, and George Wallace. And, I like being a part of this this history. And but in the end, what I love about it is a funny person is a funny person. And I'm sure that if I came up, with Bob Hope, if he were part of my generation, or George Carlin, I would have buddied around with them like I buddied around with the guys of my generation. It's a very kind of, it's a small little fun clique to be a part of, because funny people do kind of gravitate to funny people. I trust comedians so much more than I do regular people, because there is this bond that you have of this quirky little skill you have that does make you this part of this fraternity.
One more thing. Growing up with a mother who is a psychologist, a lot of kids feel like their mothers are kind of omniscient and can read their minds and they can't get away with stuff. Did you feel that way about your mother, especially since she was a psychologist?
Well, I used to do a line about my mom and my act, Terry, that she was not crazy about, which was, it's hard to picture my mom solving other people's problems when she's the root of most of mine. Yeah, she did not dig that joke. But, having a shrink for a mom is, it's different. It's weird. And in certain ways, I think they forget to take their shrink hat off and just put the mom hat on. I think that's kind of always the challenge, But I do, remember another funny story. When I was learning to drive, I went driving with my mom, and I accidentally hit the squirrel in the road. And my mother, to cheer me up, was like, you know, don't worry. The squirrel clearly displayed suicidal tendencies anyway. So don't bum out about it.
Well, Carol Leifer, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Carol Leifer's new memoir is called When You Lie About Your Age, The Terrorists Win. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America's first caped superhero, Superman, stood for morality and righteousness. But the artist who co-created him, like Superman, had a secret identity, drawing illustrations that were the opposite of everything Superman stood for. These pictures had women in their underwear being spanked, whipped, chained, having their stiletto-heeled shoes kissed, though sometimes it was the woman dishing out the punishment. Golly gee, Superman, this stuff is kinky. My guest Craig Yeo discovered the secret identity of Superman's co-creator, Joe Shuster. Yeo tells the story behind Shuster's fetish art and collects many of those illustrations in his new book, Secret Identity. The magazine that featured Shuster's fetish art, Knights of Horror, was at the center of a gruesome crime case in 1954. In 1957, the Supreme Court ordered all copies of the magazine destroyed. My guest Craig Yeo has written many books about comics. He's also the former creative director for Jim Henson and the Muppets, and now has his own design firm, Yeo Studio. Craig Yeo, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me start by asking you to describe the drawings that Joe Shuster did for Knights of Horror.
Well, these are like Superman gone wild. I mean, the characters look quite a bit like Clark Kent Superman and his counterparts, Lois Lane, Jimmy Olsen, and the villain who plagued him, Lex Luthor. You think they're the citizens of Metropolis, yet they're in these very compromising sexual situations. I've been kind of amused and annoyed that some people have called the illustrations kind of quaint or charming because they are from the 50s, but I think they're anything but. There's bloodletting and there's whips and chains and a man menaces a young girl with a cactus and there's pouring of red ants down another young lady's panties, if I could be so explicit. And believe me, I could be more explicit. The illustrations are quite strong, quite pulpy, yet beautifully composed, beautifully drawn, beautifully rendered in Joe's strong, sure style, the same style he used to create Superman, and now he's creating scenes of sexual horror.
Give us an example of the kind of similarities in illustration style between the Superman comics and the Knights of Horror illustrations that made you think this is the same guy.
Well, Joe had an unmistakable style. Very strong and sure, as I said, and the characters are kind of squat and strong, and the way it's rendered, it's when an artist's style is like his fingerprints, you can't mistake it. And I've made a kind of a career of detecting artist styles, because many cartoonists, their comic work was never signed for different reasons. Sometimes the publishers didn't like them to sign it because they were worried about their competitors stealing the artist away, or the artist getting too egotistical and wanting more money. And lots of the cartoonists were kind of ashamed to be working in comic books. They really wanted to be doing illustrations in slick magazines. So for a variety of reasons, artists didn't sign their work. So comic historians like myself have learned to detect artist styles, and everything from the squints into the eyes to the sheens on the hero's hair to the way hands are rendered, which is a usual trait that historians look for to see which artist delineated a certain strip. All these things just made me, when I first saw the Knights of Horror book that I found in a dusty old cardboard box on an antique book dealer's table, maybe just exclaim, oh my God, Joe Shuster. It was just so obviously his work.
You know, you've made comparisons between the illustration style of Superman and the characters in Superman and this fetish art in Knights of Horror. So let's look at the cover illustration for the book Secret Identity. I'm going to ask you to describe the cover illustration and then tell us what similarities you see in the illustration style and in the characters to Superman.
Well, the cover is simply a man and a woman, yet the man is half naked. His torso is exposed, and the woman is wearing frilly 50s underwear, but she's garnishing a whip above him because he's chained to a table. But the bizarre thing about this, or should I say bizarro, is that these look just like Clark Kent and Lois Lane. And Superman's in pretty much pain here. I guess he's not invulnerable to pain in this guise. And Lois seems determined to thrash out some type of punishment. It's interesting. You open the flap and it shows what didn't fit on the front cover. And there's a woman bound in the background. She looks like Lois's next victim. But she looks like Lana Lang, which in the comic books was always Lois's nemesis in Lois's pursuit to capture Superman's love. So you know, it's kind of a beautiful yet kind of a disturbing image.
Now, your book is a book of history and speculation, part history, part speculation. And you think that Joe Shuster started doing this fetish art because he was basically broke, which is an amazing story considering he co-created perhaps the most famous character in comic book history, one of the most famous characters in history. How did he end up nearly broke after creating Superman?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of historians have painted Jerry Siegel, the writer, and Joe Shuster, the artist, is always getting a raw deal. And they did, in fact, sell Superman for $130. They sold out all rights. But they were really living the life. I think they were millionaires. Just on the comic strip alone, DC was paternalistically letting them have the lion's share of the proceeds from the newspaper comic strip. And just on that, they were earning $750,000. Equivalent of what today is $750,000 a year on just the strip alone, not to mention, you know, some of the licensing profits. And they had a whole studio of writers and artists working for them to produce the material for DC. So they really did make a lot of money, but I think maybe they went through it maybe just as fast as they made it. And they did see, and it bugged them, that there was a disparity between how much they made and the publisher. And so in 1948, they sued DC Comics to try to reclaim the rights to Superman, and lost that trial, and then they did fall on hard times. And I think somewhat the fact that Joe did this work is more of the speculative part as far as his motives than the actual fact, because we don't really know quite why he did it. Many artists were falling on hard times from the comic book industry because it was under a lot of criticism at the time. Titles were being canceled right and left. But these artists were finding work in education or advertising or different venues for their work. And Joe chose to do this work. And I'm not sure he made a heck of a lot of money doing it, only about $100 per copy, according to the printer who I tracked down. And so that's where the speculation begins. What was his motive? Did he was it revenge against DC Comics, the fact that the characters do look so much like Lois and Clark and Superman and Lex Luthor and Jimmy Olsen? Or was it did he had a feeling or a fantasy or an enjoyment about this material? So that's when the story kind of gets interesting, as you imagine. Well, what was his reasons behind delineating this?
Now, the fetish magazine that Joe Shuster ended up drawing for, Knights of Horror, figures into a gruesome crime case from 1954, a case that's kind of famous, known as the Brooklyn Thrill Killers. What were the crimes, and who were the killers?
Oh, that's fascinating. The killers were four teenage juvenile delinquents who happened to be Jewish and happened to be Nazis. They were followers of Hitler and even sported Hitler mustaches, and ordering bullwhips through comic book ads and switchblades. They went into the parks of Brooklyn and terrorized victims, flogging girls with the whips and setting bums on fire and punching them and kicking them, according to things they saw in Knights of Horror.
Wait, did you say that they ordered the whips through comics?
Yes, this was one of the big criticisms of comic books is that the kids were able to get things like bullwhips and switchblades and all kinds of toys that you wouldn't want the average kid to or any kid to have in their hands. But they had at least two murder victims, the second one being Willard Mittner, who they were captured for and put on trial for.
The way Knights of Horror ends up figuring into this murder is that the court asked a psychiatrist named Fred Wortham to interview one of the defendants. And what was Wortham famous for by this point?
Well, he was a psychiatrist who dealt a lot with kids, and he was famous for being an anti-comic book crusader. He early on was horrified by the horror comics and aghast at the superhero comics for their fascism, alleged fascism.
And he was on a campaign against Knights of Horror, but the defendant who he was interviewing didn't know that. Tell us what happened in the interview and how it was used in the court case.
Yes, he had written a book called Seduction of the Innocent against comic books and called in by the court to interview the head of the gang, Jack Coslow, in his Raymond Street jail in Brooklyn. And Coslow revealed to Wortham that he was an avid comic book reader and also had and read every one of the 16 volumes of Knights of Horror, and that many of his crimes were based on ideas of things he found in Knights of Horror.
So after two of the defendants were sentenced to life in prison, there were successful attempts to destroy the remaining magazines. There was a court case that made it as high as the Supreme Court. When the case reached the Supreme Court, it was a you write all about this in your book. It was a 5-4 decision. Felix Frankfurter, who was a founder of the ACLU, declared the books to be, quote, clearly obscene, dirt for dirt's sake. And it's amazing the court ruled not only against the further distribution of Knights of Horror, it ordered their immediate destruction.
Yes. Well, the public, I think, put a lot of pressure on the courts and the police force to get rid of Knights of Horror. You know, they were so concerned about juvenile delinquency, they were so horrified by the Brooklyn Thrill Killers crimes, you know, that they wanted some immediate action. And Mayor Wagner in New York at the time assigned 80 detectives to the case to find out who was behind Knights of Horror. It's interesting. They found the printer. They found the publisher. They were starting to get to the writer, but no one ever connected the illustrations to Joe Shuster at the time. And I think they were satisfied just to get the Brooklyn Thrill Killers behind bars and the books banned, and then the public wanted to move on.
I just want, while we're on the subject of the Supreme Court case, I just want to quote Hugo Black's dissenting opinion. Justice Black wrote, "In my judgment, the same object may have wholly different impact depending upon the setting in which it is placed. Under this statute, the setting is irrelevant. It is the manner of use that should determine obscenity. It is the conduct of the individual that should be judged, not the quality of art or literature. To do otherwise is to impose a prior restraint and to violate the Constitution. It savors too much of book burning."
Yes, I mean, no matter what you think of this material, whether you're pro or con, I mean, I think every freedom-loving American would deem this a sad day in the history of freedom of the press when these books were banned.
How did the Brooklyn Thrill Killers case and its connection to Knights of Horror affect the future of comic books and the comic book code?
Well, the public was outraged. I mean, the Brooklyn Thrill Killers was like the Columbine of its time, and it was written up in Life, Time, Newsweek, Collier, Saturday Evening Post. And the government, the police force, you know, the psychiatrists and just the religious folks and everyone was wanting something to happen to, like, stop this kind of work from being published. And so even the newspapers were reporting on the anti-comic crusades, and then they would give an update on the Knights of Horror crusade against that. And so within weeks, just mere months after the Brooklyn Thrill Killers trial, that's when the Comics Code came into being.
You know, as shocking as it may seem that the artist who created Superman also did this fetish art, there is a kind of connection in some way through the publisher, in the sense that the original publisher of Superman first made his living publishing porn, And then he published a lot of fetish art stuff, you know, like magazines for, quote, art students of, you know, naked or semi-clad, you know, models. So, I mean, there was, it, not necessarily through the artist himself, but through that world, some kind of pre-existing connection.
Well, yes, it is interesting. Comics definitely had their roots in the pulps, and one of the seamiest pulp publishers was Harry Donenfeld, who did publish pulps like Spicy Tales and Spicy Detective and Spicy This and Spicy That. And the and these were like pulpy tales of, you know, half-naked folks and bondage and villainy, and definitely for prurient interest. And so when he did get into – lucked into publishing Superman and saw that it was so good and saw that so many young kids were buying it, he did try to, you know, keep a strong hand about Superman. And there's even letters that have resurfaced recently from the editor of Superman at the time telling Joe to keep Lois's bosom small and, you know, no suggestive poses. So I think there was something, you know, Joe and Jerry, his writer, you know, did enjoy the pulps and were very much influenced by them. And they're now, seeing the Knights of Horror work, you can look back on Superman and see how they're, you know, this was kind of part of Jerry and Joe's makeup, but, you know, wasn't allowed to maybe really come out in full force like Joe eventually did in Knights of Horror.
You know, in making the connection between Superman and the fetish art that Joe Shuster drew, some people always thought Superman's tights were a little kinky.
Well, I mean, he was in tidy whities, or his tidy readies, his little red shorts there were awfully tight. And I think the superhero costume in itself, it has a bit of a kinky side to it, the skin-tight costume with capes and these powers that dominate over people. I mean, the whole thing, you know, does have a kind of a kinky side to it.
When I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s, watching Westerns and old movies and TV shows about buccaneers, there were always people getting whipped. There were always characters getting hung by their arms. Women were always getting kidnapped and bound and gagged. And a lot of the poses in Westerns and pirate movies and buccaneer TV shows were really very similar to the poses in Joe Shuster's fetish art. The difference was people were clothed in the TV shows and the movies.
Yes, and even apart from genre pictures, I mean, just you know, comedies of the time, films, there was always a spanking scene. And, you know, it's interesting to see the things Joe drew. I mean, this material was illegal. It was under the counter, yet there's no showing of genitalia. And there's also a very curious convention of the time. The women had nipples, but the men didn't. Illustrators never showed men's nipples in this era because that was somehow considered obscene or politically incorrect for its time.
What did Superman comics mean to you when you were growing up?
Everything. I mean, comic books were my life, and I was a skinny kid who was getting sand kicked in his face at the beach, and to see that me, Clark Kent, could actually become a Superman, you know, I loved Superman. And due to this day, working on this book has given me a new appreciation for Superman, certainly for the art of Joe Shuster.
Craig Yeo, his new book is called Secret Identity, The Fetish Art of Superman's Co-Creator Joe Shuster. You can see several of Shuster's tamer illustrations from the book on our website, freshair.npr.org. The Beatles changed the paradigm of popular music. Bands started writing their own songs. For songwriters working in the old Tin Pan Alley system, this could have been a disaster. Rock historian Ed Ward looks at how a number of these songwriters and songwriting teams coped with the new order.
By 1965, songs like this one, sung by the Chiffons and written by the Brill Building songwriting team of Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry, were fading from the scene. a movement spearheaded by the Beatles, picked up by their countrymen the Kinks and the Animals, and reinforced in America by the likes of the Byrds, saw American teenagers opting for more serious subjects and more complex harmonies. The artists were writing their own material so that songwriters who had been used to showing up at a session with demo records of songs they'd written for the performers to choose from were becoming irrelevant. Or were they? Were all these new performers actually writing all their own material?
I can feel a new expression on my face. I can feel a growing sensation taking place. I can hear the guitars play lovely tunes every time that you walk in the room.
On the face of it, the Searchers' Every Time You Walk Into the Room was a pretty typical British invasion record, from the chiming electric 12-string guitar to the maracas used as percussion. The band was even from Liverpool, but the song was written by a West Coast-based professional songwriter named Jackie DeShannon, who had also provided the Four with their first hit, Needles and Pins. Paul Revere and the Raiders were an American success story. Regional hits in the Pacific Northwest had led to a contract with Columbia Records and a television job with Dick Clark's replacement for American Bandstand called Where the Action Is. Sure, they wore hokey Revolutionary War outfits on stage, but hey, their keyboard player really was named Paul Revere. And in fact, in their previous incarnation as Local Wonders, they, like many of the other bands on that scene, were known for their instrumentals. When it came time for their vocalist, Mark Lindsay, to sing, he used other people's words.
Girl, you got this need to know what I'm all about. Well, there's something that you dig you can't figure out. Well, now you wanna know what moves my soul and what ticks inside of my brain. Well, I got this need I just can't control, and it's a driving me insane. I can't take it. Almost tasty, baby, and sweet as wine.
The fact is, their two top 10 hits in the 1960s, Hungry and Kicks, were both products of the Brill Building team of Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, who also wrote for the Chiffons, the Cinderellas, and Gene Pitney. And the Byrds? They had two songwriting dynamos, Gene Clark and David Crosby, and were famous for their electric versions of Bob Dylan songs. But even so, they occasionally availed themselves of the prose.
Don't doubt yourself, babe. Let your feet stand up for your beliefs, babe. I know what's running through your mind. You think you ought to capture time. Make love, walk the straight and narrow.
Don't Doubt Yourself, Babe was another Jackie DeShannon song. The band knew her because she hung around the Troubadour bar like they did, so when they needed material for their first album, she had it. The Byrds even raided the Brill Building itself once for a song by perhaps its most famous team, Jerry Goffin and Carole King. The song they got later took on a life of its own. Dusty Springfield's version of Wasn't Born to Follow, a song the Byrds had put into the soundtrack of the film Easy Rider, is based on another version of the song by a band called The City. The city, in fact, pointed the direction which some of these songwriters went. It was fronted by Carole King, and although it didn't do very well, it gave her the confidence to record an album under her own name. Tapestry would go on to become one of the best-selling albums of all time. And then there were songwriters who weren't particularly successful, for whom performance might be a way out of the contract songwriting game.
I may go out tomorrow if I can borrow a coat to wear. Oh, I'd step out in style with my sincere smile and my dancing bear. Outrageous, allow me, courageous, charming. Oh, who would think a boy and bear could be well accepted everywhere? It's just amazing how fair people can be.
Clearly, someone who wrote songs like this, even if they could get them recorded by former Animals keyboardist Alan Price, was too weird for the pop market. But young Randy Newman had connections in the film music business and was lucky enough to get a contract with Warner Brothers, which gave him a free hand. Eventually, it would pay off for both parties, but by then the word songwriter would have the word singer in front of it.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schirach directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.